And it is time for information and advice on your money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 10th. And financial planner Kevin McKinley is here with answers to your financial questions. If you have a question about personal finances, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. In today's edition of On Your Money, we'll talk about whether 401ks are as good as or better than Roth IRAs. And a little bit later in the program, we'll find out how we should not save money on gas. But Kevin McKinley has some information on the latest economic news to start us off. And Kevin joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin. Kevin. I thought we lost you.
No, I was just having my hair done in the dressing room. I'm here. Good morning, Joy.
Well, Kevin, you deserve a big raise, I understand, because you are not only a multi-talented financial planner, but now you are a radio engineer.
Don't tell the union. I know that they're very sensitive about non-members touching the equipment, and I just, in this politically charged climate, I really don't need to rock the boat any further. So thank you.
Just to lift the veil a little bit, Kevin is in our studios in Eau Claire, and normally someone is there to kind of set up the radio board and, to hook up the appropriate wires so we can talk to each other. And this time you did it all by your lonesome, and we are very proud of you, Kevin.
I actually have a Wisconsin Public Radio sticker on my forehead right now for doing this all by myself. I'm a big boy now.
Well, there have been a lot of economic news stories out there, Kevin, and I was hoping that you could kind of sift through it all and tell us what's going on. Is the economy getting better or worse or staying the same?
Well, it's amazing to hear some of these things that are reported in 20 or 30 second sound bites or reported from different sources that may or may not have the complete truth at heart or just really have no way of reporting through the different metrics what is really going on in the economy. So much of the news, the real useful news, is either buried or the wrong news is put out in front, partially due to quirks in the calculation methods, but also due to just blatantly inaccurate representation. So it's very important to know what's actually happening in the economy, especially as it pertains to jobs and taxes and spending and housing, to quote some figures from the recent data dump.
Yeah, well, in that data dump, let's start with the recent job numbers. What's up?
Well, the short-term news was very good. There were about 250,000 or so new jobs created last week, but unemployment was up from 8.8% up to 9%, and a lot of people were not only puzzled by that but concerned because unemployment actually seemed to rise when a lot of new jobs were created. The reason unemployment rose is because the way the figures are calculated, a bunch of people started looking for jobs again who didn't have jobs. Just because you don't have a job and may want one, if you're not actively looking one, you are not counted in the unemployment figures. So as the economy seemed to have gotten a little better in the last few months, a bunch of people said, you know what, I think I'm going to look for a job now. So when they're looking and not getting one, they are counted in the unemployment figures. The longer-term trend for unemployment, though, is still not good at all. Most numbers that we're seeing in for people who are either unemployed or don't have as much work as they would like or don't have the kind of job they would like is still running at about 16 or 17%. And that's about twice the number you would want to see at this stage in the recovery.
So turning to taxes, so are more of us paying more in taxes?
Yes, and nobody really likes that, but it's actually a good sign for several reasons other than the fact that you're paying more in taxes. First of all, it's very difficult to manipulate taxes coming in. Either they're coming in or they're not. And yes, there is some tax avoidance in the economy, but generally it's the quickest and easiest and most accurate way to see what's going on. Federal income taxes were up 26% from October of last year to April of this year over the previous time. State income tax levels are back to what they were about 2 years ago. And on a local basis, that property tax level that funds most local governments hasn't gone down at all. And apparently the people who set the property tax rates haven't paid attention to the housing market and seen that it's gone down a little bit. But at least on a revenue basis, it means that property taxes are coming in and helping to fund local governments to the level that they have, at least for the last several years. That shows that there is money there to help finance the state and local governments. Plus, it does mean that at least there's some valuation there that can help keep people afloat.
Do the taxes indicate increased spending?
Well, that's what the number says. Consumer spending is up. The question is how is that spending rising and what is the reason for it? It's rising slowly, not a lot. But many people who are spending money as consumers know that it's not just that they're buying more things, it's that inflation is going up. So it costs more dollars to buy, say, a gallon of gas or a gallon of milk. And so that's part of the reason spending is rising. Also, credit use is up, which normally is a good sign because it means that there's more credit available and people are more comfortable taking on credit to buy things. However, there's a lot of evidence that says that they're taking on credit to fill their gas tank rather than buying a boat or a new car.
You know, I just saw something on housing numbers yesterday, and it didn't look real good. Is there any silver lining when it comes to the housing market?
It doesn't seem to be, and especially on the surface, one of the most recent numbers was housing starts. And housing starts are way down. These are people actually building new houses, breaking ground to put up a new house. And those numbers are terrible, which is very bad news for builders and developers and contractors and people involved in construction on a residential basis. However, rents are up quite a bit, and that not only helps support prices and cash flow for rental owners, but it also helps create an equilibrium between the cost to buy a home and the cost to rent an apartment or a home. And so as that gets closer to each other, more people are more comfortable buying a home than they are renting. Also, we've seen a big rise in foreclosure proceedings. Last year was a record number nationwide. First quarter was a little slow, but that's really kicked in lately. A lot of people start worrying about that and say, gosh, there's more foreclosures coming online. It's not so much that more people are going into foreclosure initially. It's more so that the banks are just pushing the homes through the process. They've been waiting and waiting and waiting to see if many of these people could catch up on their payments. And the fact is, and the sad fact is, they just can't. And so the banks are finally moving the property through the system, selling it whatever they can, getting it off the books and into buyers' hands. And that is just part of the natural process, which will bring back some form of price rise in the housing market. It's going to be a long time, but this has to happen first before we'll see any rises in the future.
All right, Kevin, even though I heard you say all that, my eternal optimist says I feel things are getting better. Am I way off?
Well, it depends on who you are and what you're measuring. Things have stopped getting worse at a rapid rate, and we're just in a very bad, bad recovery, if there is such a thing. 2 years ago at this time, we were worried more about, the financial system collapsing. We're not as concerned about that now, but we do have higher gas and commodity prices, and we may have the Fed pulling out some of the support for the financial markets in a few weeks. Both of those things could create a shakier economy in the future.
I love things have stopped getting worse. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He is a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, we welcome it at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag, and we have two questions on the same topic, Kevin. Joanne asks, if I'm collecting my Social Security monthly pension payments and money from my 403B, Are social payments taxable or only the pension and the 403B payments? And then Gloria asks, when I made out my taxes this year, I was surprised about the $11,000 of my husband's Social Security being taxable. I thought that once we are 65, none of it would be taxable. So, two for the price of one, Kevin.
Yes, and this is a good idea. Both of the longtime listeners of On Your Money know that if you want to get your question answered, start it out with some false praise. These people allegedly decided to go a different tack, and what I'm guessing is one person created two separate emails to create the illusion of a wave of curiosity about this particular topic. This is also good. It obviously works, and so let's answer
yes.
her or their questions, how many ever we have here. Social Security payments in retirement are ostensibly tax-free. However, you can lose benefits for working if you're earning income above a level under your normal retirement age, which is usually 66 and beyond. And the Social Security benefits can be taxed as income if they exceed a formula. Not only are they taxed, but it's piled on top of your other income, so it's taxed at your maximum rate that you're taxed overall.
So how does this formula work?
It seems almost made up. But what you do is you take half of your Social Security income and add in all of your other income from interest, earnings, IRA distributions, pension checks, and you even have to include interest from tax-free bonds on top of that. And if that amount is over $34,000 at the formula's conclusion, if you're a married couple filing jointly, then 50% of your Social Security is taxable as regular ordinary income. And if that figure is over $44,000 for couples, then 85% of that is taxable. And the problem with that is that for most middle-class people, especially in retirement, even if you are getting a pension and some money from a distribution of your IRA, once you add Social Security onto that, it can rocket you up through that 25% tax bracket and create a much bigger tax bill than what you'd expect.
So is there anything recipients can do to avoid paying taxes on Social Security?
Well, you obviously want to minimize income, but obviously that's not an option for many people. They need the income to live on, especially in retirement. So if you are getting your pension and you are getting Social Security, you want to draw from those to the limits of the income brackets if possible. And then if you have other options, such as savings or a Roth IRA or a home equity line of credit, all of those distributions are technically tax-free. They can support your income without pushing you up through those very high brackets. Now, you don't want to spend more than you need, and you also don't want to starve. But if you can do it by just taking what's taxable first, adding Social Security onto that, and then once you hit the limits, only pulling, again, from savings, Roth IRAs, on which the distributions from Roth IRAs are do not make Social Security more taxable. Or if you're in a pinch and you need money, get it from a home equity line of credit if you have that available to you.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and we have a line open for you if you have a question about personal finances that you'd like to run by Kevin. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. In just a little bit on the show, we will compare Roth IRAs to 401ks, and Kevin has some advice on saving money at the gas pump, things we should not do. And we have time now for your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our first caller is Bill in Oshkosh. Good morning, Bill. I'm sorry, Bill. Now I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. I said good morning.
Good morning.
And I was wondering if Kevin could give a kind of a repeat of advice he gave for student borrowing, which may seem a little not on topic, but given the economic news and the sense I have around Oshkosh, because I ask a lot of working students, well, are they students and how much do they work? It seems that they work, long hours, 20 hours, 25 hours, which isn't so bad. actually, with a full load, and study about 4 to 6 hours. It's kind of backwards, it seems to me, in a way. But I wondered if Kevin could comment on the advice of how much perhaps to work and how much to borrow. I think he gave a very good answer about that.
I do too. Kevin?
Yes, Bill, it's a salient topic, and I'm glad to hear you are talking with college students. When I randomly go on campuses and just ask college students questions, generally I'm escorted off. So I'm glad that you're able to get some answers from these kids. There was even a study done that showed the rapidly declining hours that kids actually spend studying in college. And some curmudgeons would say that's because college is so much easier now than what it once was. Others would say, well, that's because they can get information, what with the internet and all, much more easily than they could by, you know, pouring through dusty books in the library for. It's probably a little combination of both. Where I think families and students really get into a problem is when they say, look, we can only afford to spend so much of our money from savings and from income on paying for college, and therefore you need to work to come up with the other portion. There's nothing wrong with that from an aesthetic standpoint. I love having college kids have some skin in the game and some commitment to helping fund this expense, which is normally a very good reason to spend money. However, where there's a problem is if the kid working so much means that he or she is taking less credits or doing worse in school or doesn't have a schedule that allows her to get out quickly. And the reason that becomes a problem is that because, especially in the Wisconsin area, going to college, about half of the cost of going to college is living expenses. And another year generally means another year of living expenses, and you're not generally earning much money to subsidize it. So I'd much rather have families and students borrow money to go to school and take heavy class load, get the classes they want when they want, do really well in those classes, and then get in and get out in 4 years. Most college students, actually the ones who will start school for the first time in September, usually only about a quarter of them nationwide graduate from that school within 4 years. And part of the reason is because they're working so much, they can't get the classes they want. So borrowing money to go to school, you shouldn't pile up a bunch of debt from an economic standpoint for a job that's not going to pay very much. But it's not the end of the world. As we've said before, when you get out of school, you can pay off student loans in about 10 years by making 1% of the original balance in a payment form each month. So I think I saw the average dollar amount that kids are getting out of school with loans of right now is about $23,000. That sounds like a lot of money, and it is, except for $230 a month, that loan can be paid off in about 10 years for most cases. So I'd much rather have people borrow than have their kid, you know, selling shots at 2 o'clock in the morning at some bar off a campus. It's just a better way to spend money. It's more efficient and it's safer too.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill, for the call. My niece is going to go to UW-La Crosse next fall, a freshman, and she is excited to buy it, and she thought she might get a job as a bartender. So I'll have to...
Of course. Of course. What else? What other jobs are there?
I know. Very funny. Joanne in Caledonia is with us. Hello, Joanne.
Good morning. My question, Kevin, is my dad recently passed away, and my sister and I will inherit the proceeds of his estate, which is basically a house that we're going to be selling and a couple cars. And then there seems to be a bunch of accounts that he had set up for what appears to be IRA money and a pension he received from his employer. I guess what I'm wondering is, first of all, about the proceeds from the sale of the house. Once it finally does sell, I don't think I would pay taxes on my portion of that. I think there's no inheritance fee, but I'm wondering how that income will affect, you know, my husband and I. We're both still working. And then I'm wondering about these accounts, these 401k accounts. I think if I wanted to take the money for those, I'm going to be paying pretty hefty penalties and taxes. Is that, I mean, we're not talking significant dollars, but I think it's enough that it might mess me up tax-wise.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to hear about your father, and paying these kinds of taxes, like many taxes, are actually good news. It signifies that something, you receive some money from some source. So while the taxes should be minimized, if at all possible, it's from a financial standpoint, it's certainly not the end of the world. So the good news is it's highly unlikely you'll pay any estate taxes at all. It's also highly unlikely that there will be any taxes on the sale of the home, in part because many assets receive what's known as a stepped-up cost basis. And I'm just guessing that the home wasn't worth quite a bit more than what he paid for it in the first place. I mean, not millions of dollars more anyway.
Right.
So, and even then, the sale would be long-term capital gains rates, which are very low. Where you are going to get hit with taxes are from the distributions from those retirement accounts. And if I hear you correctly, those are going to be set up as what are known as decedent IRAs or beneficiary IRAs. And that's how IRAs are passed on to someone else, usually adult children. And you do have to take money out of those, Joanne, but you only have to take them out according to your own life expectancy, which if you're in your, you know, your 40s or 50s, it's generally a very tiny percentage, especially in the first year. Now, you can take more out. You can take all of it out if you want, but then it will all be taxed as ordinary income to you in the year in which you take it out. So it's usually better to take out only what you're required to take out, the RMD from that, and no more, unless you have some kind of cash emergency. Then you should just take out whatever you can get.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the information.
Yes. Thanks, Joanne. And again, sorry for your loss. Mary in West Allis emails, I have money with several different investment companies. It always seems like they are trying to sell me something. How do I know what they are trying to sell me is a good idea or not? For example, a representative from one of these companies told me that I should buy a life insurance policy. He retired, and my new representative is telling me that he would never sell that type of insurance. This is so frustrating. So what's Mary in West Allis to do, Kevin?
Nothing, actually. There should be kind of a Hippocratic oath for financial advice as well, which is just first do no harm. And part of the reason is because when you start really mucking around with investments, first of all, there could be tax implications. Second of all, there can be commissions. And both the taxes and the commissions can substantially reduce the amount of money that you once had. Now, that said, one of those people could be right, and even both of those people could have had her intentions at heart when they suggested that, you know, the first one suggested she buy the life insurance policy, and the second one said, I don't believe in that. It's still just a matter of opinion, and hopefully those opinions were expressed with Barry's best interest at heart. If you can, try to find someone whom you believe is going to only recommend things that are right for you. And that doesn't mean things that don't earn that person any commission. There's nothing wrong with the person earning commission. Most people are comfortable paying it if it is low as it's as low as it could possibly be, and if whatever they're selling is the right thing for them at that time. But a good way to look at this, Mary, and other people in this situation, is get a second opinion. Go talk to another advisor and say, is there something in this that I'm missing in terms of cost, in terms of risk, in terms of some drawbacks that this person isn't telling me? And you know, try to read the prospectus, that the 280 pages that they plop on your desk and then say, sign here that you've read this thing. Go through it and try to look at the risks and the highlights and the warnings and see if there's anything in there that really should cause you to pause on that. For most people, simple is usually better. So, especially when it's a case when people are older. But other than that, you really do have to go with kind of your gut instinct and trust your judgment, but also verify it in other places if you can.
Sounds good. And Richard in Kaukauna is with us now. Hello, Richard.
Hi. I have a question on annuities held in a Roth IRA, and it's a two-parter. First of all, are the payments taxable? And secondly, if you leave the payments in the Roth IRA, are you allowed to reinvest them and compound?
Is this a bank relationship?
No, this I haven't purchased the annuities yet. I'm considering it with the Roth IRA funds.
Okay. What are you trying to accomplish with the annuity versus, say, a normal mutual fund?
Well, I'm trying to keep from being taxed on the payments, and also allowing them to be reinvested, so the essentially the rate I'm getting is compounded.
Hmm. Okay, so is this money that's already in the Roth IRA of yours that you're considering now
yes.
using to purchase an annuity?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I would say this. Yes, the payments are tax-free. In terms of compounding, if it's a fixed-rate annuity, is that correct?
Yeah, it would be an immediate fixed-rate annuity, yeah.
Ah, okay. So this is kind of like triggering Social Security, where you, after you put
exactly.
in a larger lump sum, then it all of a sudden... And by the way, Richard, this could be just in my brain, but could you maybe turn your radio down?
I sure can.
Okay,
well, you're
you.
Hearing an echo, Kevin. Okay.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. It's not in my brain. if you take the annuities out in that in an immediate annuity, I'm not concerned so much with the taxation. What I am concerned with is if an immediate annuity is really the right thing for you, because the interest rates on those, Richard, are so low right now, and unless you are very up there in years, very old, and in really good health, you're basically just going to be getting your money given back to you. And so I'm less concerned with this being in the Roth IRA than I am with the annuity being taxable to you as it comes out. Now, if you do take an immediate annuitization, no, you cannot compound that. You can that money can flow into some other kind of investment and still stay within the Roth IRA. But you can't, if they're promising you, let's say, a 3% rate of return on this immediate annuity, you can't let those payments keep compounding unless it's a fixed rate annuity instead. So I would take one step back and just decide if this immediate annuity is the best thing for you first. If you do decide that, don't put the majority of your assets into it, because once you put it in there, it's gone. You can't get the lump sum back out of it, and so you're stuck getting these small payments in. So re-examine that, check the details of it, and you're okay with it in the Roth if you find it's all right for you, but I wouldn't put a large sum of your money into an immediate annuity.
Richard, thank you very much for the call, and good luck. Speaking of Roth IRAs, Kevin, we've had some questions about comparing Roth 401ks to Roth IRAs. Is one better or worse than the other?
For most people, the Roth IRA is probably still the best way to go. The difference is, and the reason we're hearing a lot more about this, is these are just being added to many companies and organizations, employers, at-work retirement plans. And it can be a Roth 401k or a Roth 403b if you work at a nonprofit. The Roth 401k's advantages over the Roth IRA is it does offer a larger contribution. You can put in somewhere between generally $16,000 and $22,000 into the Roth 401k if you made that much money for it. Whereas a Roth IRA, you can only put in $5,000 if you're under 50 and $6,000 if you're over. Plus, there's no income limits. Only people below income limits of generally about $170,000 for married couples filing jointly and $120,000 for singles can make contributions to Roth IRAs. But people at any income level can contribute to Roth 401ks. And some people like the notion of having the money deducted from the paycheck. So it automatically is going into the Roth 401k every 2 weeks rather than having to think about making the Roth IRA deposit in, you know, scrambling on April 15th to get your letter postmarked properly so you can credit it on that year's taxes. So
then why don't you think the Roth 401k is a better option for most people?
Well, it's usually because either they'd be better off going with a pre-tax 401k, the regular one, or a 403b and getting the tax break, or just using the Roth IRA, and in some cases using both. If you are looking at the pre-tax one, you're generally in a higher tax bracket, and you're going to get higher savings from being able to defer taxes on that money now in a regular one. And if your income qualifies, you can not only max out an at-work 401k, but also max out a Roth IRA as well. If you have low income, you really don't have a difficult or you have a hard time saving money at all for retirement, the Roth IRA is much better than the Roth 401k because you can pull the contributions back out of the Roth IRA whenever you want for any reason with no taxes or penalties. That's the contribution portion. Whereas with the Roth 401k, it's much more difficult to get at that money. So if you're worried about saving money for retirement because you think, oh, gee, this is going to be locked up for 20 years and I might need it before that, the Roth IRA is better than the Roth 401k.
So what type of saver is most suited for the Roth 401k?
It's people who think they're going to be taxed at a higher rate in retirement on the withdrawals from the account than when the deposits are made to the Roth 401k right now. And some people say, well, sure, taxes are obviously going up. I think we all know that. Well, in retirement, you get to manipulate your withdrawals generally from your retirement accounts. And so you should hopefully be able to manipulate those withdrawals to stay in a lower tax bracket. But it's usually going to be someone who is only getting part-time work, so the tax deferral isn't very valuable to them. They probably already have a larger amount in an IRA or a 401k, or they have large payments from a pension coming. They have to have enough money to live on, even with their low income, because they want to funnel as much money as possible into the Roth 401k rather than spending it on their living expenses. Sometimes people have losses on businesses or investment losses they can use to drop themselves down into the lower tax bracket, at which the Roth 401k would make better sense. And we actually have a really nice calculator that we're going to put up at onyourmoney.com later on today that will help you figure out, based on your tax rate, the amount of money you're putting in, and the amount of investment return you hope to make, which one is better for you.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. If you have a question for him, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Al in Madison is with us. Hello, Al.
Hello. I have a question about stable value funds. I'm approaching retirement age, and I have a company 401k, and I have a lot of money put in a stable value fund. Do you have any opinion on how safe those are? And with the uncertainty of the financial markets, you know, are those a safe investment in your opinion, and how much of a percentage would you recommend keeping in a stable value fund?
All right, what do you think of stable value funds, Kevin?
These are great questions, Al. For people who aren't familiar with them, stable value funds are almost always in a company retirement plan, and they guarantee a fixed rate of return that's usually a little better than what short-term CDs offer. It's right now, it's probably about 3% or so. The problem is not, I guess, with the funds in and of themselves. The problem is who is guaranteeing it. Usually it's just the company backing it up, and maybe there's an insurance kind of a wrapper on top of it, but it's not government guaranteed. And the problem with stable value funds is that if you know what you're getting into, they're okay, and especially if nothing really bad happens, like we don't get the big run that we had in 2008 on money market funds and short-term paper, partially due to all the financial crises associated with Lehman Brothers, etc. When that happens, all of a sudden, it's very difficult to get money out of a stable value fund because the securities are relatively illiquid. And so I do like them from a sense of saying, well, it's, you know, you're earning a little bit of rate of return and it's not as risky as having the money in stock accounts or maybe even bond funds. But if we do get some kind of black swan event again, stable value funds are probably going to be revealed as not being as risk-free as many people assumed they were. So I like it for a portion of your investments without knowing anything more about your situation, Al. But I wouldn't put all of it in there, and even the money that you do have in there, assume it's okay, but that it's not rock-solid safe like it would be if it were in a CD or a treasury bond.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. We have time for more of your calls in just a moment after we talk some about how not to save money on gas. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and you're tuned to On Your Money. Kevin, with gas prices hovering around that $4 a gallon threshold, some drivers are tempted to spend money so they can pay less at the pump. What do you think of that idea?
I don't think much of it, depending on where the money is going. And at least the generation, I think we've kind of banished the notion that was once held by many drivers of a certain age who would do things like, shut the car off as it was going down a hill or whatever. Hopefully people aren't doing that anymore just to save on gas. The notion that you're going to spend a little money and hopefully save lots of money on gas, it's understandable. Gas, it's at $4 a gallon right now. Only 2 years ago, it was less than $2 a gallon. And just 4 months ago, it was $3 a gallon. And so, obviously, with the price of gas going up along with other prices, certainly you want to do whatever you can to save. But there are so many things that people are doing right now to try to save money on gas, and it ends up causing way more harm, or at the best case scenario, not doing much good at all.
Yeah, so what are some examples of that?
Well, the basics are you let the gas tank get down to E and before you fill up. That's only delaying the inevitable. You're going to have to fill up on gas sooner or later, and the faster prices are rising, the longer you wait, the more you're going to pay. There's, first of all, the danger of running out of gas with no pump nearby. AAA just reported they've seen an 18% increase over the last year in the number of people who are calling saying, can you come and help me? I've run out of gas. A bigger danger is that when you let it get down to zero, there's always going to be some sediment in the gas tank. And when there's not much gas in there, the sediment is a greater percentage of the gas in the tank. And there's a small danger that some of that sediment could work its way through your engine and cause some very, very serious damage that can mean much more cost and expense than you could possibly handle than just filling up the gas. So you definitely want to at least keep the tank half full at all times if you can.
You know, some of the local media will tell us what gas station in town is selling gas at the cheapest price. I have to admit, I usually just stop at the gas station that's on the way to work, and never mind the driving somewhere else to get a cheaper price. What do you do?
Well, whichever one is selling the lucky lottery tickets, that's where I usually
right.
stop.
But, me too.
No, what I'll do is go to the regular place. Part of the problem with driving around and trying to find the cheapest gas, even with some of these apps that are out there, if there's a 5 cent a gallon difference from one place to the other and you have a 15-gallon tank, the 5 cent a gallon savings works out to 75 cents. If you're driving a vehicle that gets 20 miles to the gallon and you drive more than 4 miles out of your way there and back to save money, you've lost money. It's cost you more in gas to drive looking for the cheaper gas than you saved by actually finding it. So you're usually best off going with the closest place you can possibly find.
Do, Kevin, any of those formula additives that I've heard about or other various devices that allegedly save gas really work?
According to the manufacturers and the late-night infomercials, yes, they work very well. But according to any independent analysis, no, they do not. The government, the EPA actually lists 35 years' worth of tests that they've conducted on these different devices and formulas. They haven't found anything that works that makes any noticeable difference at all. And Consumer Reports has also done several studies of these and hasn't found anything other. And again, it's one of those cases where the best-case scenario is it's just a waste of money. Worst-case scenario is you could really do some serious damage to your car. And now many of the devices require, it's a very complex process to even get them installed into the vehicle, so it can cost you several hundred dollars just to get the stupid thing set up in your car.
What about trading in that minivan for a more fuel-efficient vehicle?
We've seen this quite a bit. Car sales for smaller subcompact vehicles are up anywhere from 13 to 18% over last year, while sales of pickups and SUVs are down 3 to 4%. And the general thought behind that is it is because higher gas prices. But the problem with the more demand for more efficient vehicles is that means that prices have gone up for those. And it also means that if you have a gas guzzler like a pickup truck or an SUV or even a minivan and you try to trade it in, you'll get less money for it. Back to our example of driving 15,000 miles a year, even if you drop your mileage So let's say you were getting 15 miles per gallon and you bump it up to 25 miles per gallon. Now, that is going to mean 400 gallons less of gas used per year. But still, it's $1,600. And so if you pay $800 more for your new car and you've lost $800 on the old car, at least from a financial standpoint, it's probably not an economical justification to trade it in. If you are going to do it, you know, buy a bike or a scooter, or better yet, spend the money taking the bus.
Yeah, so where does spending money actually save money on gas?
At your local mechanics. If you get new tires, that will help you drive more efficiently and also be safer, or at least inflate your old ones properly if they're not worn out yet. You should also get everything aligned properly in your car so that you're not only safer, but the car is traveling forward more efficiently. And finally, a good tune-up might cost you $30 or so and could save you several hundred dollars in gas costs over the next year or so, and also make it less likely that your car blows up. And keep in mind, there are several predictions that gas prices could be 50 cents cheaper per gallon in the next 6 months or so. So when you're making these decisions, keep in mind that this may and hopefully only be temporary.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we will take your calls now. Pat in Oconto Falls is with us. Hello, Pat.
Hi. I'm going to be 48 years old, and disability looks like it's going to be in my future for some medical issues. So I'm also with the Wisconsin Retirement Fund, so that I can retire about 55 years of age. So I do have a short-term and long-term disability at work that kicks in until I can get on disability with the Social Security Department. So I'm wondering, you know, do I really try to make it to retirement, or do I try to get on, you know, with the Social Security? You know, I guess I'm kind of confused on what to do or what would be financially better.
Well, first of all, Pat, I'm sorry to hear about your condition. I am very glad to hear that you are addressing this before it's too late. Many people either aren't able to or just can't bring themselves to deal with this, with the financial ramifications of it. And we are going to be talking a lot about disability and disability policies and options in the future, because it's becoming a much bigger issue going forward for people who are very likely to enter into some type of disability arrangement and how they should protect themselves. I wouldn't look on this, though, as a financial reason. Without being able to go into the numbers, I would look at it more as a medical and a health purpose. I don't think that you're going to save a ton of money by working longer unless there's some kind of kick-in for your retirement where you double up at 55 on the payment amount. Just work as long as you can. You and other people listening should know, you probably know this already, the process of applying for Social Security disability, not Social Security retired benefits, is very lengthy and very difficult. It's not a case of where you just walk in and say, hey, I can't work anymore, so I paid into the system. I want to get the money out. It's a very long process, and it can be very arduous, so it's good that you are addressing this sooner rather than later. Let me ask you this, Pat, do you have a home with a mortgage on it?
Yes, I do.
Okay. One of the temptations that many people experience when they're going through this type of really life-changing and financial upheaval is to try to pay off debt as quickly as they possibly can, because they don't want to have those payments. You look at your cash in and your cash out, and you say, okay, well, at least if I pay off my mortgage, I won't have to worry about that payment, which would be, you know, which would, my disability payments might be eaten up by that mortgage payment. I would still say, and especially in your case, you're better off having the mortgage and the money out there, because you don't know what disability is going to pay for and what your needs are going to be. And if you have the mortgage, you get to stay in your home for as long as you can and make only that small mortgage payment rather than trying to be on disability and go back in and borrow against the value of it. So whatever you do, try to keep things as liquid and as safe as you possibly can as you move forward, okay?
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah, thank you very much, Pat. And Kevin, you say we'll deal with these issues more on a future program.
Yep, it really, it's one of the things that's very very undiscussed, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, but it's a big issue that many people either don't know about it or don't think they need it, and they'd be surprised at how many different ailments that are very common can lead to a disability event. And so it's better to at least know about it now than find out about it after it actually happens.
Our next caller is Renee, who is in Independence. Hello, Renee.
Hi. I'm wondering, I'm 64 years old. I have a Roth that's maybe 2 or 3 years old. And I'm wondering, at my age, if I put more money in a Roth, am I still restricted to 5 years before I can withdraw the gains?
Well, first of all, are you working?
Yes.
Okay. Second of all, do you know what tax bracket you're typically in, if you're going to be in the 25% or 15% tax bracket?
It's going to be 25 or more.
Okay, good. That's good. That's good for you. And are you already contributing to a pre-tax plan through your work?
Well, I have been, and I have not this year because I've been thinking about saving it up for a Roth.
Okay. If you're going to be in the 25% or higher tax bracket and you think you're going to be retiring relatively soon, is that a safe assumption?
Yes.
Okay. I'd much rather have you put the money into a pre-tax plan at work, like a 401k or 403b. And the reason being is that, Renee, you're going to defer 25 to 30% of that money in taxes now, and within a year or two, pull it out and probably only pay 10 to 15% of it in taxes in retirement. So even if you keep the money safe, it's much better to do it in the pre-tax plan because you'll make a 10 to maybe 15% difference in taxes when you pull it out. And if you do have extra money left over, you can still put it into a Roth IRA as long as you meet the income limits. I'm not worried about the earnings for several reasons. A lot of people say, well, yeah, you can pull the contributions back out of a Roth IRA whenever you want, but what about the earnings? There are restrictions on getting at the earnings without taxes or penalties. Because I'd want you to invest this money relatively safely, you're probably not going to make very much money on it. Therefore, any penalties or taxes that you might pay on the earnings if you need them will be relatively small, if even non-existent in your case. So rather than even think about the Roth IRA, I would go for the pre-tax plan, save a bunch of guaranteed money right away with the tax deferral, and then if there's money left over, then you can use the Roth.
Good luck to you, Renee. And Kevin, we're almost out of time. I meant to ask you, did you end up getting your mom for Mother's Day a Kindle, an iPad, or a tank of gas?
We got her, ended up being about one-third of a blizzard at Dairy Queen that we split on a bike ride that we took with my wife and kids with her. And that was actually probably something, the bike ride, she enjoyed at least as much as the Kindle or the iPad or so. So maybe next year, Mom, try a little harder this year.
I was wondering. That's what moms really want. What's the website of the week?
Well, if you are a gas aficionado, you'll love GasBuddy.com because they have state-by-state listings of all the gas prices and where the cheapest and most expensive locations are and different apps where you can calculate and find the cheapest gas. And then you complain that, you know, Rhinelander gas was $3.82 and then you drove all the way down to Kenosha and it was $3.17 or $3.78 or whatever. And this is a general sign of a conspiracy that they're out to get you somehow. But GasBuddy.com, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And he'll be back with us next Tuesday for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.